This nation was founded on the principle that all men are created equal.
We hold these truths to be self-evident.
That all men are created equal.
I'll tell you what freedom is to me. No fear. I mean, really, no fear.
Created equal.
From WDET in Detroit, this is Created Equal. I'm Stephen Henderson, and I'm in the studio with our producer, Carrie Jr. II.
How you doing, Stephen?
I'm good. So Martin Luther King is by far the most famous African-American of the 20th century.
I mean, he's rivaling Michael Jackson, but okay.
Okay, we could have a long argument about that. I think you might be right.
Michael Jackson
might be in the same.
That's a whole other conversation.
Know. Yeah, for different reasons, though, clearly.
For different reasons.
Yeah. But, you know, one of the things I've always thought about King is that there hasn't been the sort of exposition of his life in book form as much as you would think there would be. There are some really good examples of those books, but I would have thought that nearly 50 years after his death, there would have been many, many more.
Okay,
but recently, Jonathan Eig, who was a sports reporter for a long time and has kind of turned into a different kind of journalist, wrote a biography of Martin Luther King in 2023. Really, really interesting. It's called King, A Life, and it is much more focused on King the person and where those personal traits come from than other biographies. And Jonathan won the Pulitzer Prize this spring for that work. And that made me think of David Garrow, who was another King biographer who wrote his in the 1980s about King and also won the Pulitzer Prize.
Right. Well, just to respond really quickly,
it,
to me, once you have a biography, I would imagine, okay, now we have the story that we need to understand this person in their life.
Yes.
The fact that they both wrote these, was it 30 or so years apart?
Yes.
Both won Pulitzers from it, I think tells a bit about how we have to always be updating and evolving.
The story moves.
The story keeps moving.
Yeah. So, I started to think about how differently they had to have gone about that work.
Yeah.
And they, of course, come up with very different products. There's also another very important volume about King's life, Parting the Waters, which is written by historian Taylor Branch. Mm. It's less of a biography than these two. It's really more about the civil rights movement. But I thought it would be really interesting to talk with David Garrow and Jonathan Eig about their work, about these two volumes about King's life, how different they are, how different it would have been to prepare them, and what we know now about him because we have these two volumes separated by 35, almost 40 years. Jonathan Eig and David Garrow, it is great to have both of you here with us on Created Equal. Welcome to the show.
Thanks.
Thank you.
So, Jonathan, I want to begin with you, and I want to begin with the beginning of your book, King, A Life. It starts with King as a small child. I mean, we see things in the beginning of your book that I think for many of us, we hadn't really seen or seen up close before. And it of course, gives us a different perspective on this massive icon of a civil rights leader. But I wonder what you think the importance is of including that material in the bio and what it tells us that we didn't know before about Martin Luther King. What about this early period of his life before the Montgomery bus boycott, which is in 1955 when he's about 26 years old? What does this period of his life tell us about him?
Well, it tells us a lot. And, you know, there have been so many great books written about King, including David Garrow's, and they are books that really help us better understand King and the civil rights movement. But there hadn't been a book that really helped explain King's heritage, his childhood, in quite a while. You know, I wanted to write a soup to nuts biography. And I think that in part the reason for that is that we've seen him become this national icon, this monument, this national holiday. And sometimes we lose track of the fact that he was just a regular person, that he was born Mike King, that his father was born and raised into sharecropping, and that King grows up in this very interesting, very special environment in Atlanta, where he's kind of the prince of the neighborhood, one of the princes of the neighborhood, because his father's the pastor at Ebenezer Baptist Church, and he has these huge expectations around him. And he's also this kid with incredible ambition. So it's worth knowing that, you know, he tried to sneak into kindergarten a year early. It's worth knowing that, you know, he was born Mike and had his name changed for him by his father and became Martin Luther King. It's worth knowing that, this is a kid who, when he was five, learned for the first time that, you know, he wasn't allowed to play with the kid across the street because he was white, and had to really face racism for the first time around that. So just understanding the demands his parents put on and the expectations, the fact that he was this really, you know, curious, bright, ambitious kid from a very early age is part of the picture that we need to see.
Yeah. And of course, much of what you put together in that early part of the book comes from an unpublished autobiography that his father wrote. Talk about finding that. Talk about the ability to include that material in the bio, which is something that other biographers, of course, to this point hadn't had.
Yeah, Daddy King, as everybody called him, worked on a biography that was never published, an autobiography, I should say, that was never published. And not only was that manuscript sitting in an archive that nobody knew that it was even there, but there were also the transcripts of the tapes he made while he worked on that. And that's just one of the many new discoveries. You'd think somebody as well known and well researched as Dr. King that there wouldn't be much new to say, but there were lots of new archival discoveries, as well as thousands of pages of FBI transcripts that have been recently released that David Garrow also has made great use of. Mm-hmm. So I think that the manuscript that for King's father was especially important because it really it was written before a book that he published later. So the insights were fresher, and it's really deeply personal. He talks about the fact that he wants his kids to be financially secure, like a lot of parents, he's not sure he wants them to go into the ministry because he's more concerned about their financial stability, like a lot of parents of that generation, who survived the Great Depression. And that then he was very nervous about his son taking this position of leadership and was really, really feared for his life, even from the earliest days of the Montgomery bus boycott, that he didn't want to see his son put at risk. These are very human, normal emotions. But we, again, think of Martin Luther King as being, sort of, sprung out of thin air. And he wasn't. He came from parents who were worried about him.
Right. David Garrow, I want to bring you into the conversation, of course. Your biography of King, Bearing the Cross, is written in the mid-1980s. It's published about 18 years after King is murdered. And, of course, there is a different picture of King that's popularly accepted at that point than there is now. There's a much less robust understanding, I think, of his life and the complications of his life. And so your book starts with the Montgomery bus boycott in 1955, which is, his entrance onto the national stage. I really wonder what you make now, though, of this information about King as a really young person and how that maybe would have informed the way you went about the work many decades ago, and how does it change your understanding of the things that you wrote about?
You're exactly right, Stephen, that I very purposefully began Bearing the Cross with Mrs. Rosa Parks in Montgomery, not as John has with King's family origins and birth. Because I believed back then and really have always believed something that Miss Ella Baker said that I quote on the final page of Bearing the Cross, that the movement made Martin, not Martin made the movement. Mm. And so I fundamentally view Dr. King's public life as a product of the Montgomery bus boycott and how the black community there in Montgomery drafted King into being the prime leader of the new community organization that pursued the boycott. As I know John fully agrees, King was not someone who sought out a public leadership role. And indeed, as he became more and more famous through the years, he became more and more uncomfortable mm-hmm. About this degree of celebrity and praise that was focused on him and that he quite rightly felt was excessive, that the credit for the movement should be understood as being shared far, far more broadly. But John's book is a huge step forward in our understanding of King's life before Montgomery, especially the family origins in and before Atlanta.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Patrick Parr some years ago did a landmark book on King's 3 years at Crozer Seminary in eastern Pennsylvania, 1948 to 1951. And both John and Patrick, thanks in part to, the internet, which did not exist in 1986, were able to, discover not only resources, but in Patrick's case, some people, whom the technology of the 1980s, just didn't enable me to locate.
David, I also am curious about the difference between who King was to America in the 1980s, which is really close to the time that he was alive and close to his murder. As I say, your book is published 18 years after he's killed, and who King is now, and I guess how the path of narrative and biography that unfolds over that time changes the way we think of him. Is he a different and fuller person now than he was when you were working on this book?
Yes. I started meeting all the people whom I call King World in 1979. I first met Dorothy Cotton, who's mm-hmm. a hugely important
yes.
figure in King's life, in September of 79. I was only 26 years old then, and I was frankly too young to appreciate how close in time for older adults 1968 was.
Right.
Just 11 years, to a 23-year-old is one thing. 11 years to a, 55-year-old is something significantly different.
Mm-hmm.
So I had the benefit of having almost everyone who'd been involved in the movement with King still available to meet and talk with, from 79 up through 85. John has benefited tremendously from, and this will sound odd to anyone under the age of 40 or 45, we have so many newspapers, particularly old African-American newspapers,
yeah.
that are now digitized. Are easily searchable. In my era, you were looking at reels of microfilm and a microfilm reader, which, you know, induces, you know, nauseous headaches.
Yeah, there's a bunch of people listening. There's a bunch of people listening who have no idea what word you just used.
Oh, yeah. Microfilm probably is. Yes, exactly right. Oh, no, but I mean, you know, John can talk about this better, but, you know, he found, you know, items that, you know, King as a teenager wrote for the Atlanta Daily World, the premier black paper there, you know, that we just, that not only Garrow, but the King Papers Project at Stanford had entirely missed.
Yeah, yeah. Jonathan, in an interview, you compare your work to David's and, of course, to Taylor Branch's Parting the Waters, which is, of course, another standard bearer, I think, is probably the right term when it comes to thinking about King and the civil rights movement. And I kind of like the way you described it. You said that David and Taylor were telling a giant story with King at the center of it, and you were telling King's story with this giant story on the periphery of it. And I think that gets to just a fundamental difference of what lens, I guess, you're using to tell the story. You're really trying to unearth him in ways that I guess we hadn't before.
Yeah, that's right. And I think these books complement each other really nicely in that way. And of course, I had the advantage of reading those books and working around them.
It's a little
them,
bit of a cheat.
They didn't have. So I could also assume that readers, if they wanted the whole big history of the civil rights movement, would go to Garrow and Branch, and that I could write something different. I wanted to write a much more intimate portrait, one that made you, you know, hold your breath and cry when you get to the end. And I think it's fair to say that Garrow and Branch were not trying to do the same. I wanted to just, and part of it is a factor of time. We've lived with those books for a long time. We've lived with the King holiday. Mm-hmm. We've seen him turned into this sort of two-dimensional figure by many. We've seen his name and his words misused by politicians who are promoting policies that he would be horrified by. And I felt like it was time for a book that reminded us of his humanity, that he was flawed, that you don't have to be perfect to be a hero and to be as courageous as he was. And that it would just, you know, it would be a book that would exist in a different space than some of those that had come before.
Yeah. Okay, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we are going to continue this conversation with Jonathan Eig and David Garrow, two authors of biographies of Martin Luther King, both Pulitzer Prize winners. We'll be right back with more Created Equal. Welcome back to Created Equal from WDET in Detroit. I'm Stephen Henderson, and today I'm talking with Jonathan Eig and David Garrow. They are both authors of biographies of civil rights leader Martin Luther King. They are both winners of the Pulitzer Prize for their work documenting King's life and struggles. I want to start this segment with an idea, I guess, with the two of you. David, there is a huge part of King and King's life that is about doubt. Doubt that he has, doubt that is kind of instilled in him, and how he deals with that doubt. I want to talk about the role that plays in his life, but also the role that it plays in your work, trying to document who he is and what he meant to the country.
Right from the first 2 weeks of the Montgomery boycott in December 1955, King doubts very greatly whether he's the right person to be put forward in this leadership role. You know, he views it, and certainly in retrospect, very consciously views it as a sort of historical accident that, you know, he rather than Ralph Abernathy or someone else ended up in this role. And the way that King comes to terms with that doubt is through his religious faith.
Mm-hmm.
What my dear friend, the late Jim Cone, James H. Cone, C-O-N-E, what Jim and I back in the early 80s started calling the vision in the kitchen of the parsonage there in Montgomery, 309 South Jackson Street, where King had a sort of crisis of faith late one night when he and his family are being deluged with, you know, racist hate phone calls.
Mm-hmm.
And King feels, you know, the voice of God telling him to be strong, to go forward. And it's you know, his whole upbringing to that point in the church, as John talked about earlier, and his family's, you know, deep roots in the church. So it's a sort of concomitance of his family history that allows him, you know, reluctantly, unwillingly, to have the strength to go forward in this role that he didn't at all seek and oftentimes, frankly, did not enjoy.
Mm-hmm. And there are things that happen to him that I think accelerate or maybe enhance that doubt. David, you've spent a lot of time in the FBI's files, which are, of course, voluminous about King and what he was doing and what was happening to him. Talk about those external forces, including the FBI, that sow this kind of doubt and concern that he had.
The FBI begins wiretapping King's closest advisor, Stan Leveson, in New York in 1962. They expand to also wiretapping two additional close advisors, Clarence Jones and Bayard Rustin. And then in late 1963, they start wiretapping King himself in Atlanta. I first started getting the logs or transcripts from those wiretaps in the early 1980s. And on balance, ironically, the FBI surveillance records give you a more positive emotional feeling about who King was.
Mm.
Because again and again in those, you see how selfless he was. When he first learns that, you know, Time magazine has named him, you know, man, as they said back then, man right. of the year, he essentially says, oh, geesh, what's one more plaque to put on the wall? So he's never someone who is taking joy, you know, from awards and attention. Indeed, he comes to feel increasingly burdened by all the requests that people are showering down upon him. And that's really the trajectory of all of the early Southern freedom struggle efforts that King was in. He gets drafted in Montgomery. Bayard Rustin and Miss Baker and Leveson sort of push him to create the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, his civil rights group. The students in 1960, you know, bring him into the sit-ins. The Freedom Riders bring him into the Freedom Rides in 61. Albany, Georgia in 61.
Mm-hmm.
Fred Shuttlesworth in Birmingham in 63. So again and again, King is being carried forward by the efforts and initiatives of others.
Yeah. Jonathan, what about this doubt that he that he harbors. In your book, you spend a lot of time talking about the things that troubled him and troubled him right up to the end.
Yeah, of course, you know, it gets worse toward the end. But even as a young man, even as the Montgomery bus boycott is turning him into a star, he's writing to his old college professors and saying, what do I do now? They're going to expect me to pull rabbits out of my hat. And I'm only, you know, 26 years old. I'm sorry, 29 years old. It's a great dilemma for him. And of course, he's wondering if he's up to it. And yet he feels, as Dave mentioned with the vision in the kitchen, that he's called to this by God and that he can't turn back, that it would be a betrayal of his very faith if he were to turn back. And one of the ironies of the FBI wiretap thing is that we get to hear him at his most vulnerable. We get to hear him saying, I feel like no one's listening to me anymore. I feel like I'm being betrayed by my own followers, that the press is turning on me. So, you know, it has the effect of humanizing him in a way that I'm sure the FBI never dreamed.
These doubts that King harbors for such a long time, and throughout much of his career, talk about the ways in which he tries to deal with them. There's a lot in your book about the approach he takes to soothing this doubt and being able to keep moving forward, even though he was not as certain as he might have seemed publicly.
Well, I think he had a great number of people around him who helped him overcome his doubts, beginning with Coretta Scott King, of course, who was not just the wife who stayed home and took care of the kids, but was a real moral lantern for him, leading the way and reminding him that she was in this with him. That doesn't mean their marriage was perfect. He had mm-hmm. other women as well, but mm-hmm. Coretta played a very important role. He had a great group of advisors, and he had a whole nation of people that he felt were looking into him, that were counting on him, and that he felt a great sense of responsibility not to let those people down. And he talked about the feelings of that burden, but he also felt like it was an awesome responsibility. He said over and over again that his activism was an outgrowth of his ministry, and that he felt a duty and a responsibility and a privilege to be a pastor to not just his congregation, but to the world.
Yeah. David, in your book, we start in 1955 in Montgomery and go forward from there. Talk about how King changes over that period, the growth that we see in him in the book as a leader, as somebody who is, you know, thinking so deeply about what he's doing and what it means and purposely changing some things to be able to lead in the way that he wanted to. There's an element to this story that seems very much like the Odyssey, which I always say is kind of the predicate for most American fiction. But this is a true story. I mean, the journey here is such a key part of his life.
Throughout the early years of his involvement in the movement, King always believed that this would be a finite commitment, that it at some uncertain time in the future, he'd be able to retire from this role and go back to being just a pastor or a college professor. But after 1963, 1964, the reluctant realization dawns on him that this is a role he's never going to be able to escape. And that gives him an increasing sense of fatalism. Now, he had believed from early 1956 all the way onward that at some point he would be killed. And this was not any sort of obsession or preoccupation. it was just a rational analysis of the role he was in and how many threats were directed towards him. But that realization also increasingly gives him the strength to willingly be unpopular. We see this, of course, most dramatically when he speaks out strongly against the war in Vietnam in 1967, at a time when the war was still, you know, endorsed by the vast majority of American Democrats. We see it also more subtly in King's willingness to become increasingly outspoken in public or in semi-public staff settings about his economic views, which were always, going back to the early 1950s and with Coretta, were always sort of fundamentally democratic socialist in nature. But King was understandably very wary about saying too much about how much economic change he felt the United States desired. And so we you know, especially 1966 and after the last, you know, 2 years of his life, there's this increasingly courageous strength he has, even though he full well realizes that, that his outspokenness is making him less popular and is cutting into white folks' financial contributions to the movement.
Jonathan, there's a chapter in your book called "The Most Dangerous Negro," and it deals with the aftermath of the March on Washington in 63, the reaction to it, and that description. Talk about what was meant by that and where that kind of marks a turning point in King's journey here, that that he does become different in these later years.
Yeah, it's not that he's really different. I think he's speaking out on economic issues pretty early in his career as an activist. He's speaking out on Northern racism and Northern segregation pretty early, but he begins to focus on it more in those later years, and, you know, moves to Chicago in 1966 and really decides that it's not enough to call out segregation in the South and not enough to fight for voting rights in the South, that it would be hypocritical not to point out that people in Chicago and Philadelphia and New York were segregating in their own toxic ways. And that's when he begins to really run into some public relations problems. The Northern media isn't as interested in covering that story. And that's when, you know, when he begins talking about economic issues in Vietnam, that's when the FBI begins to say that he's dangerous, that it's they're not worried anymore that he's a communist. They think that he poses a threat to the status quo, and in particular to capitalism as we know it. And I think that's when you start to see them using this kind of heightened language of concern about where he might lead this country.
The FBI surveillance, as we've said, is incredible in terms of its scope and the time and how much that they're focused on King and worried about him. I wonder what both of you think, though, we learn about him from that surveillance and the reports on it that we wouldn't maybe otherwise have known as much about. David, I think you said earlier that in some ways it kind of backfires. I mean, he comes off as more sympathetic in these files than they would probably have wanted him to. But there is so much of it. What do we know about King that essentially the FBI helped us know?
Stephen, I'd stress two things. First and foremost, you know, everything the FBI did towards King was not a secret. You know, Robert Kennedy, as Attorney General, you know, approved the wiretaps. His brother, the president, knew all about it, too. When the FBI expands from wiretaps to using microphones in King's hotel rooms, all of that, the full raw transcriptions, go to Lyndon Johnson, you know, as president, Kennedy's successor. And a significant number of people in official Washington outside the FBI all knew what was going on. Yet the journalistic norms of that time were that this didn't get reported. With King himself individually, there's a lot of tremendous value in seeing how Stan Leveson, Clarence Jones, Bayard Rustin, you know, how all of his advisors and Stan in particular was totally selfless, how they try to help strengthen King. It's a really important supportive network that he has there. Now, the personal life issues, John touched on this earlier, there are, you know, several dozen, you know, women in King's life, you know, just from 1963 to 1968, the most important of whom by far, Dorothy Cotton, you know, worked with him in SCLC in Atlanta. King's dealings with women were not terribly unusual for that time. John Kennedy in the White House, as is very much out there on the public record, had a lot of similar issues or problems too. You know, when you're under electronic surveillance, there are no secrets in your life.
Right. Okay, we're going to take another quick break. And when we come back, we'll continue this conversation with Jonathan Eig and David Garrow about Martin Luther King. Stay where you are. We'll be back with more Created Equal. We're back with more Created Equal from WDET in Detroit. I'm Stephen Henderson, and I'm talking with David Garrow and Jonathan Eig, two biographers of Martin Luther King. David Garrow's Bearing the Cross was published in 1986. Jonathan Eig's King: A Life was published in 2023. Both volumes won the Pulitzer Prize for biography. So I want to start this segment with Dorothy Cotton. And I want to talk about the difference in sort of the understanding of her and her relationship to King between the two books. But also, I don't want to overemphasize that to the exclusion of the importance of her role to the movement and to the work. I think when you think of King, you have to think of Dorothy Cotton, among lots of others, but in a very primary way, powering the movement. Jonathan, I'll have you start because you are able to write differently about her in 2024 than someone would have been in the 1980s.
That's right. On the most personal level, we can now acknowledge the fact that Dorothy Cotton was a hugely important person in King's life, that often when he came home from his travels, he would go to see her before he went home to see his wife and kids. And there were people in the movement who knew and thought of her as being almost a second wife in many ways, that she provided just a huge level of comfort and understanding and affection for King, who was under, of course, enormous pressure all of his life. And in the larger context, it's worth remembering that she and so many others, women were vital to this movement, and King had a blind side. He didn't see their abilities as leaders necessarily. Mm-hmm. He didn't recognize their potential as leaders. Ella Baker, among others, you know, had a lot to offer as executives, as administrators, as organizers, and King sometimes failed to appreciate their potential. But nevertheless, it was the women in the movement, from Dorothy Cotton to Ella Baker to, you know, so many others, Joanne Robinson, as David referenced before, who made this movement go, and that there would have been no Martin Luther King without their work.
Yeah. The personal relationship between the two of them, talk about how much more we understand about that today than we would have 30 years ago, and why. What is it that makes that possible?
Well, for the most part, it's that she wanted to be private about her personal mm-hmm. relationship with King. Mm-hmm. And as long as she was living and preferred to be private, we scholars in the field, and David can speak to this, protected her privacy. And she told friends about her relationship with King. And of course, everybody in the movement knew about it, but mm-hmm. she did not want it to be public. She did not want to be known as simply as she was worried, I think, that she would be known simply as his great love, as one of yeah. his loves, but not as the great activist that she was. So
exactly. If I may chime in.
Yeah, go ahead.
I mean, Dorothy was an immensely warm, effervescent person. But she nonetheless made it very clear that she did not want to be pigeonholed. And so neither in Bearing the Cross nor in my earlier book from 1981 on the FBI's pursuit of King mm-hmm. did I explicitly identify Dorothy's full role in King's life, though it's there in ways that most people reading it could understand.
Right.
And as John said, that was entirely because Dorothy herself did not want that to become the sort of controlling public narrative. To me, Stephen, especially in those last 3 or 4 years, Dorothy's emotional sustenance for King, as he comes under more and more public stress and strain, is really centrally important in King's life.
Mm.
Now, as John knows too, they had a fight in Memphis the night of April 3rd, mm. and Dorothy left and flew back to Atlanta on the 4th. And when she lands at Hartsfield, she learns that Doc has been killed. Mm. And so Dorothy had to live with that burden, you know, privately for decades.
Mm. Wow. Wow. I do want to talk about the role that King plays in America, both before and now. I think there's something really interesting about a near 40-year stretch between these two books and who King was to America in the 1980s and who King is to America in 2024. Jonathan, I'm gonna start with you because your volume is the most recent look at King's life. But give me a sense of how much you think he has changed to us over that time. I mean, he has been gone a long time now, but people have been writing about him since he left, and I wonder what you make of what Americans feel or know or understand about King today that maybe they didn't 30 or 40 years ago.
Well, one thing we've seen happen in the last 25, 30 years since the creation of the national holiday is we've seen King's message watered down. We've been offered the opportunity and we've seized on the opportunity of embracing the parts of his message that make us most comfortable. So we talk about the dream, and we talk about judging people by the content of their character and not the mm-hmm. color of their skin without mm-hmm. recognizing that in the first half of that same famous speech, the I Have a Dream speech, he talked about things like police brutality and income inequality, and that if he was speaking at the March on Washington for jobs and freedom.
Yes.
So some people who I interviewed, some of King's closest friends, wondered sometimes if the government did it on purpose, if they knew that by honoring King with this national holiday, they would have the opportunity to de-radicalize him, to defang him.
It would strip him of, yeah, that's really an interesting idea. I mean, I talk all the time about how he's become almost like a Christmas character in popular American narrative, that he is not, his ideas are not to be feared by the status quo or white America, but that they can be used to kind of quell black agitation about what's going on in our country.
That's right. And Harry Belafonte said, we don't teach radical heroes in America. We don't teach radical history, even though radicalism is at the root of American history. And he encouraged us to read the first half of King's I Have a Dream speech and not to let students off the hook only reading the second half.
Yeah, yeah. David, what do you see in terms of the change in who King is to us over that time? And again, going back to the time that you were writing about him, which is much closer to his death.
I wish we had much, much more attention paid to the history of local level struggles. Now, Montgomery, thankfully, has really blossomed in people's understanding of that. Mrs. Joanne Robinson and the other women who really got the boycott started. But when we look at other places, Birmingham or Selma, even though those are very well-known names, there's no widespread public understanding of how incredibly courageous Fred Shuttlesworth was in Birmingham, that without Fred, what takes place there in 63 would just not have been possible. And King himself felt very much that way. So did Miss Baker, that they wished that all of this fame that is so highly concentrated on King, could be much more inclusively shared.
I have one last question, and it may be an unfair question, but I'm going to ask it. You're two white guys writing about the most famous African American of the 20th century, and I struggled to think of a King biography of this magnitude that has yet to be written by an African American. And you know, the other major biography that we referenced before is Taylor Branch's look at the civil rights movement, Parting the Waters. I wonder what you make of that. Why have we not seen an African American telling of this story at this level? David, I'll start with you.
When I started work on what became Bearing the Cross in 1979, and this will sound very, very strange to most listeners today, I was like the only person doing this. I mean, there was astonishingly little interest in unearthing civil rights movement history, really until Eyes on the Prize, the mm-hmm. famous PBS documentary series in 1986.
Yeah. Yeah, Jonathan, why do you imagine we're not seeing this story told from an African American voice?
Well, I would just first of all give a shout out because we need to acknowledge that people like David Levering Lewis and yes. Michael Eric Dyson and Tommy Shelby yes. and Brandon Terry have written very well on Dr. King over the years, and in yes. fact, David Levering Lewis did it before anyone else. Also, Lawrence Dunbar Reddick wrote the first King biography, and it's a fabulous, really important work. So I think that, every generation we need new King biographies, and we will see more coming. And there's right. certainly no, I think it's in the spirit of Dr. King that we should all write about him. And if we write about him well and do service to the story, then we all add to his legacy.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, guys.
Stephen, if I may just quickly add, I think especially with regard to all the personal life challenges King confronted, that as time goes by, we need women's voices discussing King, analyzing King, and not just all of us who are male, irrespective of color.
Yeah. No, great point. Great point. Yeah. All right, guys, really great to have both of you here, and it's wonderful work. 40 years nearly apart, about the same person, really different perspectives, gives us all kinds of food for thought about, again, the most famous African-American of the 20th century. Thanks so much for joining us on Created Equal.
Thank you.
Right. Thank you, Stephen.
That'll do it for us on Created Equal. Be sure to listen to our recent episodes at WDET.org, and we would love if you would subscribe to our podcast, where you can leave us a rating or a review. Created Equal is produced by Carey Jr. II and David Lines. Our audio editing is done by Connor Anderson, and the music is by Sam Bobian. Created Equal is a production of WDET, a listener-supported service of Wayne State University.